All right, I think it's time to start. As usual, let me start by asking if you had any questions left over from last week's discussion. Anything that didn't make sense that you wanted to talk about or ask about or complain about or argue is wrong or anything of that sort. You're allowed to argue that things are wrong. They sometimes are. On the reading, I think we've really got sort of three different things we're talking about. One of them is price discrimination, and it as the way in which price discrimination feeds into the interaction between IP law and antitrust law. The second is the Kaplow article, which is quite a neat article, I think. And then the third is a bunch of other stuff at the in section D of the reading. So let me start by asking whether you have any questions about the price discrimination. All right, let me run through briefly what's going on there before we go on to the Lou Kaplow article. Basic idea starts with the sort of standard textbook model of a monopoly, where the monopoly is selling all of its product at a single price to people. And the standard economic argument is that the monopoly will raise price above its marginal cost because, unlike a competitive firm, it knows that it has a range of prices over which the higher the price, the less it sells. The perfectly competitive industry, if you charge a penny more than the market price, you sell nothing. If you charge a penny less, you can sell all you want. The monopoly is the more realistic case, except that it's really a continuum between the two, where you say, well, we could charge a dollar a cookie and sell some cookies, 50 cents sell lots more, 10 cents sell lots more, and so forth. And the monopolist has an incentive to keep raising his price above his cost of production, because each time he raises his price, he loses some customers, but he also gains money on the customers he doesn't lose. And from the standpoint of the economists, there's an economic inefficiency because there are people who are not getting the product who value it more than it costs to produce. And from the standpoint of the monopolist, there's a loss of potential profit in two places. There are people who value the product at more than it costs to produce, he's not selling it to because he's charging a price higher than that. And there are people who are buying the product but would be willing to pay an even higher price if he could only figure out how to charge it to them because they really like the product. So perfect price discrimination would mean some way of charging every customer who values the product at least its cost the highest price he's willing to pay. That's sort of the monopoly's nirvana. And interestingly enough, perfect price discrimination eliminates the standard inefficiency of monopoly, because now everybody who values the good at its price gets it. It's true that all the benefit goes to the monopolists, not to the customers, but as economists, we're sort of agnostic about who gets benefits. We're just looking at the total. There is, however, one problem with perfect price discrimination, which I want to mention. It turns out that it's not really a problem in the case of patent law, but it's a problem everywhere else. And that's what's called rent-seeking. And the argument is that if you know, think about the natural monopoly. Natural monopoly is the case where the reason you're a monopoly is that one firm can produce the product more cheaply than 10 firms could. All right? And where that's true partly depends on the size of the market. All right? I'm a natural monopoly for a tiny market of people who are interested in the kind of talks I give. But arguably, you might have some industries where there was a single firm, where you had a large fixed cost and then a small variable cost, and therefore, the more you produce, the lower your average, and you can therefore undersell smaller firms. Natural monopoly story. Suppose I see there's going to be a natural monopoly 10 years from now in some developing niche. It would pay me to start a firm in that niche now, lose money for 10 years, in order that when the time arrives, I'll be the one sitting in that niche making the monopoly profits forever after. That's rent-seeking. That's a case where I am spending money in order to get a benefit that would be there anyway. Somebody else would be in the niche if I wasn't. I'm just trying to make sure I have it. All right? Logically, it's exactly the same problem as why theft is inefficient from an economist standpoint. Because you might say, why should we worry about the pickpocket? I'm $20 poorer, he's $20 better off, we don't care about the distribution anyway, we don't have anything much to say about it, so why isn't that just a wash? And the economist's answer is, because if you could make $20 picking pockets, you will divert labor into that job rather than to productive activity, so now the guy who's making $20 an hour picking pockets is giving up an $8 an hour job at McDonald's. that is a net loss. He's really only getting a $12 gain for my $20 loss. Furthermore, if Picking Pockets is that profitable, more people will go in, and they'll keep going in until you're giving up an $8 an hour job at McDonald's in order to make $8.01 Picking Pockets, at which point my loss has got nothing to balance it. That's rent seeking. Same argument implies that one inefficiency of monopoly, not normally included in the textbooks, is that you may spend resources becoming the monopoly in an unproductive fashion, such as losing money for 10 years in order that people will see you as the firm in that industry. Now, in the case of IP, that's not a problem. In the case of IP, this, to use the standard jargon of Silicon Valley, is a feature, not a bug. Because in the case of IP, we want to give you an incentive to get the monopoly, because how do you get the monopoly? By making an invention that you patent. All right? But it is worth noting, since we're talking about antitrust in general, that there is this consideration. And this was the classic article on rent-seeking, which hardly anybody knows, was by Gordon Tullock, and it was called The Welfare Costs of Tariffs, Monopoly, and Theft. And you can see why monopoly and theft come into it in that way. All right, that's a digression, but I thought it was worth making. All right, real monopolies can't do perfect discriminatory pricing. That my story last time was to imagine a monopoly, all of whose customers were identical. And it can then say, we will charge you an entry fee for the cookie club and a price equal to our cost. The entry fee will pick up all your benefit from being able to buy cookies at that price. Perfect monopoly pricing. Real world, even if we knew the individual customers, they're different. So the price schedule that covers, that works for one won't work for another. So, yeah. Oh yeah, sure, but if rent seeking is a problem in any case where the way in which you get the monopoly is not itself a productive activity that we want. All right. The one classic example is the explanation of what was wrong with the Homesteading Act. That the Homesteading Act, it paid you to farm land beyond the frontier at a loss in order that you'd be the one who got the ownership of that land when you had fulfilled the homesteading requirements. So, all right, so real-world price discrimination, one way of doing it is to separate out your markets, to charge a lower price for the book in England and in the U.S. Another way is to provide different variants of the product that will appeal to different customers, hardcovers versus paperbacks, or getting your ebook before it's published instead of after, but paying more to do that so that you'll be one of the first among your friends who knows what what happens in the next book in the series, that kind of thing, and so forth. Then, 2 points are worth noting. One of them is that all of these variants require some amount of monopoly power, because otherwise, if I can make money selling the book cheaply in England, then somebody else could make money selling it cheaply in America, so I won't be able to sell it at a high price in America. It all requires a product that does not have perfect substitutes, which is probably a more precise way than saying monopoly power, because monopoly power makes it sound all or nothing. All right. So if I write a book, I have some monopoly power because there are people who will have differing values for that book, and other books aren't identical, but other books may be close enough so that that's going to limit the price I can charge. The other thing that's worth noting is that the efficiency implications of imperfect discriminatory pricing are ambiguous. That you can set up situations in which the deadweight cost, the net loss, if we add up benefits to everybody, in which we are on net better off with price discrimination without it, and you can set it up the other way around. And if you think about my English-American case, the reason why you may be better off is that you are producing more units of the book because you, in England you're selling it at a price which it wouldn't pay you to price if, to do it at the in the combined market, and that's going to depend on structure of demand. If you imagine the case where any American who will buy the book at all will buy it for $10, so you charge it for $10 in the U.S., nobody in England will buy it for $10, but lots of them will buy it at $8, you charge $8 in England, you now are producing more copies of the book, providing benefit to people, net gain. All right. On the other hand, notice that one result of that kind of price discrimination is that you are no longer providing the book to those who value it most. Because an Englishman who values the book at $8.01 is getting it, an American who values it at $9.90 is not getting it. All right? So one feature, if you imagine sort of an all-wise social planner handing out books, one thing he would do is say, all right, how much is the book worth to each person? Give it to everybody who values it at least its cost of production to nobody else. So you would therefore be giving the book to those who valued it most. Price discrimination, you are no longer necessarily giving the good to those who value it most, because part of the price discrimination involves charging different prices to different people. So this isn't an econ course, I don't want to go into a lot of detail, but the basic bottom line, which I think is somewhat obscured in Kaplow's otherwise excellent article, is that the deadweight cost of allowing the kind of practices that might be in violation of antitrust is sometimes negative. That is, it is sometimes the case that if you allow people to do tie-in sales, you actually give them their incentive at a lower cost than if you didn't. Whereas most of his article makes it sound as though expanding the things that the patent monopolist can do always has some increased deadweight cost, and the only question is that a price you're willing to pay? All right, is the point clear? That price discrimination... Imagine suppose there were no issue of patent incentive at all. Suppose the only question is how much damage does the monopoly do versus how much money does it get? There are cases where allowing a monopoly to price discriminate means it gets more money and does less damage. Damage is an odd way of putting it, but it gets more money and the total benefit to it plus its customers is larger rather than smaller. And there are other cases where that's not true. It can go either way. Questions? No. All right. Let me then run very briefly through the issues that show up in IP versus patent conflicts. One of them I mentioned before is the tie-in sale. When I say I will only allow you to use my patented computer if you use my cards to go into it. My patented printer, I'll only sell you if you're willing to buy paper from me. Another is resale price maintenance. That's the case where the wholesaler says you may not sell below a certain set price. And you can imagine a number of reasons for doing that. It's not entirely clear what the right answer is. The sort of standard econ answer is that that's a case where the wholesaler wants the retailers to compete in non-price features. So imagine that I'm selling high-end audio gear. And it'll work much better if there are showrooms where the customers can come in and listen to the product. However, there's going to be a problem if when the customer goes into the showroom, which costs the retailer a lot of money to maintain, he's got in his pocket the address of the low-cost seller next door, who doesn't have a showroom, and so he listens to all the stuff, free rides and all the information, and then goes to Amazon and orders the product. All right? Lots of us do that nowadays. So the argument is, if we have a minimum resale price maintenance, now you can't have the low sale guy taking it away. Everybody, in order to compete for customers, they can't compete by lowering the price, so they compete by providing services. So that's a possible explanation. I'm not sure how good an explanation it is. I've always wondered in all of these cases why you don't just sell the services. If anybody wants an entrepreneurial idea, which I assume won't work, else somebody else would do it, but struck me as a good idea, having a car company which, instead of selling cars, sells the service of helping you to buy cars. So if they specialize in minivans and you come into the car company and they've got 8 different minivans, all of the available, all of the top 8 models that they know of from the different companies, and they charge you $50 an hour, for which you get to drive one, then the other, which is much better than doing them on different days because you can compare them. You get to check their library of review articles, talk to their experts, and so forth. And then you would separate out the equivalent of the lab for listening to the stereos from the selling of them. And I have not figured out why that institution doesn't exist. And if you can figure out a good way of making it exist, I would appreciate it if you would give me at least a credit and perhaps make a small donation to Santa Clara University out of your first $50 million of profits. But I don't guarantee it'll work, because my usual prejudice is that when my clever ideas aren't being done, it's because they're not so clever as I think they are. because there are lots of people with an incentive to make money. Anyway, but that's a standard possible explanation. You can think of other explanations. I've seen it argued that in some cases, the idea is that customers believe that if you see a cheap price, that it's a cheap product in the other sense. Cheap in English both means inexpensive and low quality, depending on the context. So some argument is that the wholesaler says, we don't want anybody to sell it at a low price. They'll think we're a cut-rate product. We're really the elite product. And so possible story, don't know. Another one is the market division, who can sell it where, and that looks like price discrimination along my example of England versus the U.S. You could also imagine the case where it's not geographical, but by uses, where I have a patented product for making something, that something is used in several different industries, and I deliberately make it available at a high price to the industry where it's really important, at a low price to the industry where there are good substitutes. So you can think of things like that. There's a discussion, I think, briefly in one of the things you've just read about end product pricing or end product licensing, where instead of saying I will charge you per unit of my patented input, I say I will instead you have a license to use my patented input, I'll give it to you at cost, but there's a charge per unit of your output. And the argument for doing that is that if I put my licensing fee on the input, you have an incentive to substitute away from it, to use an inefficiently low amount of that input compared to others. Whereas if I say my input is better, you're going to get an advantage, I want you to use lots of it, so I'll charge you by the amount of output you produce rather than by the input you use. So all of these are examples. One more sort of fun one, which I think I may have mentioned, it's one at least economists like, is the block booking puzzle. And this was where movie producers, movie studios, said to the theater, we won't let you show only our cowboy movie. For a single fee, you get a license for our cowboy movie, our detective movie, and our romance. Why? And the economist's answer was that they assumed that different theaters had different demands, that essentially the demand for cowboy movies varied more between theaters than the demand for the combined product. Suppose we say there are some neighborhoods where people like cowboy movies, some where they like romances, some where they like mysteries. If we set a single price for the cowboy movie, the ones where they only like mysteries and romances won't pay us anything. We can only get this market. But if we insist on selling the block, then, in effect, these ones are paying for this part of the block, these for this part, and these for this part. If total demand is fairly similar across them, we can come closer to getting the highest amount people are willing to pay by selling the bundle rather than by selling the individual. That's another possible example. And you can think of various other things of this sort. But the basic story in all of these is that the old antitrust view was that these were ways of leveraging a monopoly to get a second monopoly. The critique when economists got involved with it was no, because any requirement you impose as a condition of using your patented thing lowers what you can get paid for that. So there's got to be a different explanation. It's not that you're getting a monopoly on printers and a monopoly on paper. It's rather that you're getting more money out of your monopoly on printers because you're able to use the paper charge to charge a high price to heavy users and a low price to low users. And that's at least arguably an efficient arrangement. And then the final question, in a sense, is does the use of these devices give the monopolist a higher reward than he ought to get? So that the monopolist argument is always going to be, look, if I didn't make the invention, nobody could use the invention. If I didn't make these printers, nobody could use my printers. If they're willing to pay this price in higher paper in order to use my printer, that must reflect the value of the printer, so it's really the proper incentive. And that really gets us into the Kaplow article, which is a noticeable chunk of your reading, which is really on the question of what's the proper incentive and how to give it. All right. So let me stop for a moment because I'm now finished with price discrimination. If any of you have any questions, yes.
The input output.
Yes. No, there was that was in the reading, and I don't remember anymore what their example was. But imagine that I've got a insecticide, or I've got some product which increases grain yields. And it costs me very little to produce it, but I've got a monopoly because it's patented. And I could go to the farmers and say, if you want to use my product, I'll charge you $100 a gallon. And if I did that, some of them would pay that and use it, but a lot of them would say, but I'm not going to use it very much, it's really expensive, so everywhere I can, at some cost, do without it, I will. But I say, no, I'm not going to do that at all. I'll give you a blanket license, you can use as much of it as you like, I'm going to sell it to you at 50 cents a gallon, but in exchange you agree to me that for every bushel of wheat you produce, you'll give me 10 cents. So now they have an incentive to use it wherever it's worth using, and because it's lowering their overall cost of producing wheat by at least 10 cents a bushel, they're willing to agree to my terms. All right, makes sense. That would be an example of final price licensing. All right, let me go on to the Lou Kaplow article. And the Lou Kaplow article really starts with the simple formula, which I've discussed early on and mentioned is not quite right, which is that the way you get everything invented that's worth inventing is to have the reward from an invention be equal to its social value. So we say, you made an invention. Suppose we had some way of figuring out exactly how much the society is better off because you made that invention, which is something like the benefit people get from the invention between now and the time someone else would have made it, plus the amount that you're saving because somebody else doesn't have to make it because you made it. All right, does that make sense as a concept? We say, ideally, how much would you be willing to pay if we had to for that invention, we as a society? Well, we say if the patent monopoly gives you that reward, a reward equal to the social value, then everything will be invented that's worth inventing. Right? That's our first approximation. What's wrong with that, Lou says? What's wrong with that is that that's forgetting that it costs us something to give you that reward. So imagine that all we were thinking about was the length of protection. And suppose we had figured out that 13 years of patent protection gave you a reward exactly equal to the social value of your invention. Well, Lou says, that's true, but those 13 years of protection also mean that for 13 years, people use less of your idea than they otherwise would have because you're charging for licensing. People have to hire lawyers to figure out whether they're trespassing on your patent or not. Maybe there's some litigation, $1 million a throw on each side for patent litigation is the figure that shows up in the book, and probably it's more than that now. So therefore, giving you that reward costs us something. Well, maybe 12 years of patent protection would give us almost as much invention. Don't know. If it would, the extra little bit of invention from the 13th year, invention of things that wouldn't pay to invent for 12 years protection but would for 13, might be less than the deadweight cost of that last year of protection. All right, does the argument make sense so far? So the right way of thinking about it is not to say set the reward equal to the benefit, but rather keep increasing the reward until the cost of increasing the reward a little bit just balances the benefit increasing the reward a little bit. The benefit is a little bit of extra invention, the more the reward for invention is. The cost is the deadweight cost due to having a patent monopoly on some product for a year longer. If, when we go from 10 years protection to 11 years protection, we get an extra $1 million worth of innovation for only $500,000 of deadweight cost, we ought to do it. If the next one is $900,000 for $600,000, you should do it. When you reach the point where expanding protection a little bit more increases the cost of giving the incentive just as much as it increases the benefit, you should stop. Right. That argument clear? Straightforward argument. It's a neat argument, and the interesting thing is that it had not occurred to people otherwise, because once you see it, it's obvious. I should say I was discussing this paper with my son, who is an undergraduate at the moment, yesterday, because it's a neat paper, and I said, you know, what's wrong with reward equal to benefit? And he thought about it and said, I don't see. And I said, well, look, and started giving this. Oh, obviously I should have seen that. All right, that was his reaction. And he's right. Once you see it, it's obvious. Now Lou says, once we do that, we can see that this is also an issue, not only with regard to the length of protection, but also to what the patent monopolist is allowed to do. So if the patent monopolist is allowed to do tie-in pricing, that also increases his reward. That's a substitute for additional years of protection. So we might say we've got a choice between 12 years and we allow tie-ins, or 13 years and we don't allow tie-ins. Suppose those gave the same incentive to the inventor. Suppose the tie-in gave him as much money as that last year. Now Lou says all we have to do is to ask, is the extra deadweight cost from allowing tie-ins more or less than the extra deadweight cost from the extra year? Now, my answer is, well, that's an easy one, because there is no extra deadweight cost for allowing tie-ins. Tie-ins probably make the system more efficient, so they probably reduce the deadweight cost. So in that case, you just certainly allow it. But he's asking, and that's my only complaint about the paper, is that he doesn't really make it clear that in some cases the cost of allowing things that might violate antitrust is actually negative, because they're things we shouldn't be prohibiting anyway. But he mentions that at one point in the paper. Mostly he doesn't. But the general point is that if you're considering any question at all about what should the monopolist be allowed to do with his monopoly, patent monopolist, the form of the question you want to ask is, how much do we increase his reward relative to the amount we increase the deadweight burden of giving him the reward? So if allowing him to do X, Y, or Z, whatever it is, means he gets an extra $1 million and deadweight cost goes up by $500,000, sounds like a net gain. If the alternative is giving him that $1 million by an extension of patent term, which costs more than $500,000, all right? Let me make it clear. It isn't that as long as he gets more than it costs us, it's a gain. Because what he's getting includes the monopolist is able to sell his product at a higher price. Part of his gain is a transfer. Other people paying money he gets. That's not a deadweight cost. All right? So the relevant question is, of the different ways of giving him an incentive, what's the cheapest way of giving him the incentive? And you want to give him his additional incentive in the cheapest way. And you then want to decide how much incentive to give by saying, given that we're giving it to him in the cheapest way, what is the payoff from additional incentive? Keep increasing the incentive until any additional increase no longer provides you a net benefit. For anybody here who is an econ major, it may not have occurred to you that we've just duplicated in this case the standard procedure early in your course of how you go from a production function to a total cost function. All right, let me explain that because it's sort of neat, even though most of you aren't econ majors. Imagine you're a firm. Your production firm function tells you all of the ways you could produce automobiles. All right, there isn't one way of producing an automobile. You could use more labor and less machinery. You could use less labor and machinery and more inputs, being less careful not to waste steel, for example. You can think of all sorts of different bundles of inputs that will produce the same output. And, of course, the same thing is true for you in your daily life. If you're thinking about dinner, one way of producing dinner is a certain amount of money and go to a restaurant. Let me recommend, there are now a couple of little non-fancy Korean restaurants, both on Saratoga Avenue, just south of the 280, and they both give you good value for money. We had dinner at one of them, I think, 2 days ago. I like them. You can also do it by buying frozen stuff and just heating it up, or you can do it by buying the ingredients and making your dinner. Supposing you could do equally well with all three of them, which you probably can't, you would then say, all right, what's the cost to me of buying it at the restaurant? What's the cost to me of money plus time of doing it with frozen stuff? What's the cost to me of less money but more time of making it myself? And you could then say, in order to get this output, there are a number of alternative bundles of inputs, price each of them, and figure out which is the cheapest way of doing it. All right, so you're going back to the car company and you say, here are all the possible ways I could be producing cars. If I wanted to produce 1 million cars a year, what's the cheapest way of doing it? How about 1,100,000? How about 1,200,000? You then say, all right, if I work out the cheapest way of producing any number of cars, I now have a total cost function, a function which tells me this is what it'll cost me to produce 1 million cars, this is what it'll cost me to produce 1,100,000, 1,200,000. Now I look at the total cost function, I look at what I can sell the cars for, and I decide what maximizes my profit. All right? That's the basic logic. Well, we're really doing the same thing here. We're the social planners, the imaginary, benevolent people setting up our system. And we say, look, what do we want to produce? We want to produce incentive.
We can reduce incentive with different mixes of inputs. We can reduce the incentive by having a longer patent term. That'll give us more incentive. We can produce more incentive by increasing the number of things that the patentee can do with his monopoly. We allow tie-in sale, tie-in restrictions. We could increase the incentive by making the patent broader. All right, those are all dimensions on which we could increase the incentive. So what do we ask ourselves? We say, well, if we wanted to give him an incentive of $1 million, what's the cheapest way of doing it? What combination of breadth of patent, length of term, and what you're allowed to do, would give him $1 million at the lowest net cost to the rest of us? How about $1,100,000? How about $1,200,000? We now have a social total cost function for giving people incentives, and we can now say, given that, what's the point at which more incentive stops giving us a bigger benefit than a cost? Stop there. That's the guts of the Kaplow article. Notice, by the way, that not only, I mentioned before that sometimes you can give him more incentive at a negative cost if you allow him to do something which actually increases efficiency. But if you believe Kitsch, then broadening it also gives him more incentive at a negative cost. All right, if you accept Kitsch's argument, I'm not sure it's right, but it's only a possible argument. Kitsch says broader patents actually result in more efficient development, not less efficient development. Well, if that's so, broader patent both gives you more incentive to invent something and results in lowering the cost, the social cost of the patent system. Win-win. All right? That's logically possible. That it's worth sort of, when you're thinking of things in a theoretical mode, remembering that costs can be negative as well as positive. All right? And obviously you like them better when they're negative instead of positive. The cost of making that dinner, that labor cost might be negative if you enjoy cooking. And then you ought to do your calculations, including that fact, right? All right. Any questions on this stuff? Notice one thing which I don't think he discusses, but which is implied by sort of combining the two things we've just been talking about. And that's the possibility of price discrimination by the patent system. That I've been talking as if the optimal incentive, the optimal rules were the same for all inventions. All right, but it might be the case that there are certain classes of inventions for which either the deadweight cost of giving the incentive is higher or lower, or the social benefit is higher or lower relative to that. So you might say, look, this is an invention which nobody on the face of the earth would have made for 1 million years. So therefore, the social benefit of that one is really big because it means that we've got that invention forever and we would never have had it. That's one, 8 or 9 years, somebody else would have gotten it, not so large. So you can imagine a sufficiently sophisticated patent system fine-tuning it. So the patent system is price discriminating. That is, the patent system is offering a higher reward to some than others. And it can price discriminate not only on the basis of how large the benefit is, but also on how much of an incentive it takes to get the invention. All right? Suppose there are some... Well, let's go for a moment to copyright. Suppose you believe that of the would-be authors in the world, of whom there are 123 million, by my latest count, that 1 in 10 can really write a good novel. And furthermore, most of them will do it for free because they want the status of being a novelist. Well, in that case, you don't really need to give very much a reward to get good novels. You want some sorting mechanism so that readers can figure out the 1 in 10 that's worth reading. Whereas if you believe that medical drugs are very expensive to produce and therefore you won't get them unless there's a large reward, then for medical drugs you might want strong patent rules. That would be true even if novels were more important than medical drugs. The relevant question here is not sort of one dimension of deciding what reward you want is how important it is to get the thing. The other dimension of deciding what reward you want to offer is what reward will it take you to get to make somebody willing to produce what you want. All right. So to what extent the patent system does that is not clear. We've got a little bit of variation among things, and you could imagine the PTO being more or less skeptical about claims in different fields. I don't know, but it is worth mentioning that possibility. Now, I thought I would mention sort of on a digression the fact that really what struck me last year when I read that Kaplow article was for the first time was realizing that I had written it. Now, it's true my topic wasn't exactly the same as his because he was writing about patent law and I was writing about criminal punishment. But in fact, the guts of the two articles were the same. Because I was writing in a literature where it was assumed that the right rule for criminal punishment was that the probability of being caught and convicted times the size of the punishment should equal the damage done by the crime. And the argument was we want to deter all crimes where the offense does more damage to the victim than the benefit to the offender. You can imagine ones in which that's not true. If you think about somebody who is speeding in order to get to a very important appointment, it might well be that the extra risk to other people of accidents is less. Or to take Posner's classic example, which is the hunter lost in the woods and starving who comes across a locked cabin with cans of food and a telephone and he breaks into it. That's an efficient offense. So the standard argument in the law and econ literature was you want the expected punishment, the average punishment, to just equal to the damage done, deter all offenses that we want to deter and not the ones we don't. And I pointed out in an article that that was true only if the cost of imposing punishment was zero. And that once you realize that imposing punishments was costly, you then say, well, there might be some offenses we'd like to deter, but deterring the slightly inefficient offense, the one where the benefit to the criminal is $99 and the loss to the victim is $100, if that costs us $20 worth of prisons and court times, it's not worth doing. All right? So I then wrote a number of things in which I was pointing out that the right rule is just like Kaplow's rule, is that you want to increase your punishment until the cost of imposing a higher punishment just balances the benefit of the additional deterrence. So I thought that was sort of funny. And my article was published about the same time his was, too. I checked this out after I came across this one. So it was a matter of two different branches of the law and econ literature, in both of which people were making the same mistake, and he spotted it in the patent context, and I spotted it in the criminal context. I should also add, Kaplow is someone I think highly of. He's sort of on my short list of people who, when they disagree with me, I listen to them. All right. I think that, for the moment, covers my first two categories and covers it faster than I thought I was going to cover it. Yes.
I just had a quick question on reading of the article.
Uh-huh.
I guess I don't really quite understand what, I don't know.
I'd have to look at it, but going back to my price discrimination case, you can imagine one invention if the good is the good from giving people an incentive to make an invention. The good depends not only in how valuable the invention is, but also in how much more likely you are to get it with the extra incentive. So if you imagine on the one hand, suppose there was some category of invention where all the ones worth making would get made with a 1-year patent. Even if it's an important invention, the good from extending term of protection from 1 year to 2 years is zero. You're getting no extra inventions. On the other hand, you could also imagine one where extending it from 1 year to 2 years gave you extra inventions, but they weren't very useful inventions. So what's the bad? The bad is the deadweight cost associated with giving the protection. That might also vary for different ones. If you have, I would argue, for example, that one element of the deadweight cost of IP protection is aside from the cost of an extra price for licensing, the cost to other producers of figuring out whether they're violating your rules, of litigating and so forth. I would argue that that's a low cost for a copyright and a high cost for patent. So that's not within patent. That's two different IP regimes. But that's a case where you might say one element is benefit, one element is cost. You might say the cost of protection is high for patent and low for copyright. And the benefit of protection is high for medical drugs and low for novels. All right. And in each case, the reason it was low might be that the additional incentive didn't produce much, or that what was producing much wasn't a very large value or whatever. All right. So, and that's where you would get price discrimination. And for any of you who remember the very first reading for this course, which was two chapters of my book, Law's Order, I was really arguing that the difference between copyright law and patent law was a form of sensible price discrimination by the legal system, in that copyright law offered much longer protection than patent law. But that was all right, or at least might be all right, might make some sense, because copyright law is creating the kind of property rights that don't have large costs of enforcing them, because you've got fairly sharp boundaries, whereas patent law is trying to produce lines around ideas, and ideas have very fuzzy boundaries, and therefore doesn't work very well. Make sense? Yes?
I think that argument sort of breaks down with the fair use.
That's right. That's right. I agree. I'm oversimplifying. It also breaks down because modern copyright law has expanded copyright to cover things like look and feel, which are beginning to look more like patent kind of things. But so my argument really is clearest if what we're asking is copyright law that prevents you from taking my book and bringing out your own edition of it. And that it's really, you're not going to do that by accident. It's going to be really easy for me to prove you did it. And therefore, it meets my requirements. But certainly, things like fair use, this is a very general issue about law in general. It's sometimes put as standards versus, what's the term? Standards is one term, and I forget the other one. Rules versus standards, maybe. The question is, do we say it is illegal to drive more than 60 miles an hour? Or do we say it is illegal to drive at a faster speed than the current highway conditions warrant? All right, if you just think about that trade-off. The advantage of the standard, as the current conditions warrant, is that if some idiot is driving at 59 miles an hour in a pouring thunderstorm where he can't see 15 feet in front of him, we can give him a speeding ticket. All right? The disadvantage is that every case becomes a matter of judgment. And when every speeding ticket, the person, on the one hand, he can argue, look, I was in good shape, I was wide awake, the road was clear, there was no traffic, nothing real wrong with my going 90 miles an hour in my Mercedes under those conditions, and maybe he's right. So that rule exists in a sense across, it's hard to think of any area of law where you don't potentially have that trade-off. All right? Murder, for example. We, you know, think it is or isn't a murder, but not quite clear because, I mean, I wasn't really aiming at you. I mean, I was aiming at that squirrel that was right over there, and I thought it was a good enough shot, so I had no chance at all of hitting you. One question which the court has to decide was, where am I lying? But another is, should I be liable in some fashion, even if it wasn't deliberate murder, for manslaughter, for being so foolish to try to shoot a squirrel that was only 3 feet from you? And not doing it with an air rifle, which would have done a good deal less damage to you. I noticed, by the way, on a complete tangent, that there was a news story about somebody in Russia shooting somebody else in an argument over the philosopher Kant. When you read the story, however, you discover he shot him with an air pistol. Air pistols really do harm, but they're very unlikely to kill anybody. They're much better for killing squirrels than for killing people. So, and I tend to sort of notice. My theory about the media is that there's only one really consistent bias across the media, and it's not political or religious or ideological. It's in favor of making a good story. So that it's in the interest of anybody pretty much in the media to think of the way of telling their story that will make it look as good as possible, as interesting as possible, as exciting as possible, and so forth. And I concluded this a long time ago when I was involved with an organization, SLAM, which does historical recreation, and where the number of people involved in the organization is really pretty ambiguous. You know, does it count anybody who comes to one event during the year or only hardcore members? And if a reporter was observing this medieval tournament and they said, how many people are involved? And you give them a detailed answer about, you know, this many, it's always the largest number that shows up if they have any number at all in the news story, because that makes it a better story. And I similarly suspect that news stories on how many people show up in the crowd at a demonstration tend to pick the highest believable figure they can, because it again makes it a better story. A general issue that you ought to all think about that has nothing to do with IP is evaluating sources of information, because we're all bombarded with information, and one ought not to believe most of it. I've argued for a long time that one of the real virtues of the web is that because it's an open forum, unless you're brain dead, you rapidly figure out you can't believe something just because it's on the web. Whereas people are so foolish as to think you can believe something just because it's in a published book or a magazine or a newspaper, which isn't true. I mean, if I don't know if any of you had the experience, but if you observe stuff written about something you actually know something about, then you will frequently discover that what they're writing just isn't true, that it's dishonest or incompetent, or, you know, there'll be lots of different ways of being untrue. So one of the skills you want to cultivate is read something and ask yourself, does this sound as though the author cared whether what he said was true? Does he qualify his statements? Does he mention the evidence against what he's claiming as well as for it? That sort of thing. And I came across an example of this pretty recently in my other work for the other seminar, where I was reading a very prominent scholar on Islamic law, and he had a couple of statements not about Islamic law but about 19th century intellectual history, which I didn't think sounded plausible, and I checked, and they were complete nonsense. He was saying almost the precise opposite of the truth about the two people he was discussing, one of them in particular. So at that point, I assume that when he's writing about Islamic law, I can't be sure when he's wrong because I don't know enough, but I shouldn't put too much reliance on what he says. And that's a good rule in general. All right, before I go on to other stuff, since I think we may have more time than we need actually today, which would be nice, I suppose, do people have questions either on price discrimination? Notice, by the way, that you will, if you have any sense, be engaged in price discrimination for most of the rest of your lives. That is, if you are a lawyer, one of the questions you want to ask yourself is, how much can I get this client to pay? Another question is, how much do I want to do this case? So you might say, well, this client will only pay me less than my normal rate, but it's a case I believe in, or it's a case that will get me good publicity for later cases. You can have lots of other reasons, so I'll take it. Or going the other way around, this guy will pay my normal rate, but I don't want to be associated with a sleazeball in the news when it turns out what happened. But among equally attractive clients, you also want to say, this one, I can get $200 an hour, this one $300, this one $400. You probably won't be that precise, but at least have in the back of your mind. And of course, remember that people are doing the same thing to you, so that you may not want to make a point of how much money you have if you're dealing with somebody who's trying to decide what price to charge you for something. All of this is relevant, useful information, nothing to do with IP. But. All right, let me then go on to the first of the issues that's raised by the rest of the reading for today. And that is really coming back to the issue that we ran into when we were reading a bit from Thomas Jefferson about the very beginning of the patent system. And that's the question about two different ways of making sure that there are only valid patents out there. What are the two fundamental approaches to deciding who gets a patent, as they were in the first few decades of the American history and as they still are? What's one way of doing it? We do both, of course, but what's one way of making sure?
The first person to invent something?
No, that's the criterion. What's the mechanism by which you make sure, whatever our criteria are, we have to have some mechanism by which people who pass the criteria get the patent and those who don't pass do. What's one way of doing it? So one way is by litigation. And that was the original, almost the original U.S. system, that you say, just like copyright. All right, copyright, you get the copyright automatically. There is no examination for copyright. And so you could have, as we had for a while at the beginning of the history of the U.S., tell us what you want a patent on. We'll give you a patent on it. Ah, you want to enforce that patent. That's different. Now the person you want to enforce it against is going to violate your patent, and you're going to sue them, and the court will have to decide whether it's right. All right. And if you were sort of thinking about it when you were reading the readings for today, you will notice that issue is still live. The other mechanism, obviously, examination. The other mechanism is you have an administrative body, the PTO in the case of patents, and their job is to weed out the bad patents. If you think about it a little more carefully, you'd like to think about the incentives for all of these people. So what is the incentive problem for the PTO, at least according to one of our readings? Whether it's true, I have no idea. Why does the reading think the PTO will issue too many patents? Think about In statistics, we refer to errors of the first sort and the second sort. One category of errors is deciding something is true when it's false, and one is deciding it's false when it's true. And any mechanism for deciding what's true, you're going to be trading off these errors. All right. I don't know. Have I commented here about the pattern recognition software that we have built into us, or was that the other class? That human beings have pattern recognition software that's so good that it can even find patterns that aren't there. That's why we see, you know, an elephant in the clouds, but that's also why we see conspiracy theories about what really happened on 9/11 and stuff like that. There's a reason our software is that good. Imagine that it's 20,000 years ago, and there is a bush, and there might be a tiger behind that bush. Which error is more expensive? Thinking there isn't a tiger there when there is, or thinking there is a tiger there when there isn't? All right? Makes sense? Thinking that there is a tiger there when there isn't means you'll miss some yummy berries that were on the bush. Thinking there isn't a tiger there when there is means that you go to eat the berries and the tiger eats you. So that would suggest that when evolution is designing our software, it designs it in a way which accepts a high rate of errors of thinking something is true when it isn't in order to get a low rate of thinking it's false when it is. Similarly, the patent office. The patent office could act in a way which is designed to make sure that no bad patent ever gets through. They could act in a way which is designed to make sure that no good patent is ever stopped. And in practice, there's some compromise between them. And one of the readings argued that that compromise goes too far in the direction of letting patents through. There was no real explanation how you define too far. And the argument was that patent examiners are paid per case settled, and that it's easier to settle a case by allowing the patent, because who's going to complain? If you deny it, you'll get appeals and so forth and so on. So I don't know if he's right or not, but it was an interesting argument. It's a question worth thinking about in any organizational design at all. What are the incentives of the people, and therefore what mistakes might it pay them to make? Think about that in the context of criminal law, for example, where our theory, at least, of criminal law is that we are much more reluctant to convict innocent people than to acquit guilty people. There are various proverbial phrases about better than 10 than 1 or better than 101, depending on who you're quoting. And not quite clear why, but that is sort of our doctrine. It's not clear it's true. That is to say, there are lots of people who say, no, in practice, it's pretty easy for innocent people to get convicted. All you got to do is to charge them with something much worse than you think they might have done, get them to plea bargain even though they're innocent for what you're charging them with. Zap, you've got another notch on your belt or on your gun butt or wherever you keep score, another gold star on your report card, and you as the prosecutor can say, I did a good job. Not clear. But yeah, again, thinking about incentives is worth doing in lots and lots of contexts. All right, so the argument then is that there was a noticeable... Are people familiar with the institutional shift that some of these articles are about? That basically it used to be the case that patent litigation went to the district courts like everything else and then went to the ordinary appeals courts and then to the Supreme Court, but it almost never handled a patent case. And the result of this, not surprisingly, was noticeably different patent law in effect in the different circuits. And there was a change which involved setting up the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which became the appeals court for all patent laws. Meanwhile, there's another thing going on which may or may not be related, and this is part of the problem of figuring out whether these people's conclusions are right. And that was that you had had a period when the judiciary tended to be very anti-patent. For whatever reasons, and there, my guess is it's more nearly ideological than anything else, but where there was a strong feeling against monopoly, a weak feeling about the desirability of encouraging invention, and therefore patent cases that did reach a high-level court the patent holder tended to lose. It then shifted away from that. And some people would argue that was due to the CAFC. I don't know if that's right or not. Incidentally, talking about incentives, here's an interesting question. What are the incentives of the courts about how they should bias their decisions in their own interest? Imagine And this is I'm thinking not just about U.S. courts at present, but in all courts in all systems. Imagine you have a system where the pay of the judge does not depend on how many cases he deals with. How would he like to arrange his decisions, assuming that he's as lazy as the rest of us? What result would he like in such a system? Yeah?
As few cases as possible.
One of the legal systems I cover in my other course is the legal system of Imperial China. And that was a society where you were, this is 19th century, where you're ruling something like 100 to 200 million people and doing it with a fairly small bureaucracy of elite scholar officials, people who've passed a high-level literary test, essentially, to get their position. So what do you have? You have a legal system where anybody within his right mind stays out of it if he can. Because, after all, not only can the defendant be tortured, so can the witnesses. Everybody who gets involved in the legal system is expected to be very, very humble and subservient to the important people who are running it and so forth. Well, that makes a lot of sense if you're deliberately trying to economize on your legal resources and you want only the most important cases to get to court. On the other hand, imagine the opposite case, and I'm thinking now of a piece I read about the history of the English courts. Suppose the pay of the judge depends on the number of cases. Now, the interesting question is, who decides what court a case goes to? Imagine a reasonably complicated legal court system, which England had in the 18th and 19th century, in which the plaintiff can decide whether to sue the defendant in this court, that court, or that court. Which to some extent happened in our system because of the circuits. All right, you could do forum shopping. So if you can do forum shopping, and if it's the plaintiff who decides, if the judge's salary depends on how many cases come to him, is he going to be pro-plaintiff or pro-defendant? Pro-plaintiff. If the judge has a fixed salary and he wants to minimize his work, is he pro-plaintiff? It's an interesting way of thinking about the system. And I, in fact, read an article. I no longer remember the details, so I won't try to repeat it to you. But there was arguing that there was a major shift in, I think, 18th century English common law as a result of changes in the rules for paying judges. Such that the incentive of the judges as to how to deal with, I think, tort law became noticeably different. So that's an issue which comes up here with regard to the PTO, but which is a much more general issue. So what are yes?
I was wondering, looking in from the outside, the internal process in those heads, kind of to say, okay, this leads to, you know, providing the incentive to, you know, applications and so forth. Have you thought about what actually goes on in the individual judge's head? Because I don't think they're going to say, well, I can make more money, so I'm just going to do this. But at the same time, you kind of have to assume there's something going on, maybe unconsciously.
Yeah. No, it's an interesting question in general. That's sort of the economist's assumption is that people do maximize their welfare. And at the same time, the obvious observation is that everybody in the world believes he's benevolent. And that everybody believes that what he wants to do in his own interest actually serves the general interest. You know, what's good for GM is good for the U.S., I'm sure was an honest statement. And, you know, that's one reason you work for GM is that you believe that. But we all have an incentive to do that, so that I'm pretty sure that on, not all, I'm sure there are cynical people, but I think that an awful lot of political issues, the people who are lobbying for what benefits their industry, really in their heart believe it. And why do they believe it? Part of the reason is that we all believe much more in the things that are close to us. So if you have let's take a steel tariff. Steel tariff is going to make the steel industry better off and other people worse off. But if you're in the steel industry, those people are far away from you. The people you know are your fellow executives, your employees, and you're a good, benevolent employer, and you realize that steel tariff will be selling more steel, we'll be able to hire more employees, we'll be able to give them better wages. Everybody wins. You know, those people far off who are buying cars, they're sort of invisible to your moral intuition. It's true of all of us. Somebody, I think Mencken has some comment somewhere about, you know, being more disturbed by stubbing your toe than at hearing of a flood on the Yangtze River that killed a million people. Because they're far away, they're foreigners, you don't know any of them. And I think that's a very natural, maybe even a desirable human trait, given that we aren't competent to make decisions far beyond what we know. But it also means that something that benefits us and those around us is likely to be really seen by us as good, even if there's no good argument to think it's good. Even if what we're really doing is taking money from them and giving it to the people around us. And of course, the flip side of that, if you look at all of the immigration arguments, that most U.S. political arguments on immigration ignore the welfare of the immigrants. All right? Think about all the people who say, I am in favor of helping the poor. We therefore have to keep immigrants out because they will compete with low-skilled American labor and drivers' wages. And I say, well, yeah, that might be true. What you're saying is that you are trying to protect people who are making $15,000 a year at the cost of people who are making $5,000 a year, namely the immigrants who are in very poor countries who want to come in. That's not helping the poor, but it's helping the poor who matter to you, because those immigrants are foreigners, they're distant people, they're hypothetical people, whereas the poor you're protecting are sort of people you see around you. And I think that's, again, it's part of how human beings work, for good or ill. All right. Let me go on to a question which struck me as sort of, it's a, again, one of these general issues that shows up in the reading, and that's the empirical studies of courts, where you've got an article which says that if a case goes to a judge, this is likely to happen. If a case goes to a jury, that's likely to happen. Or for that matter, one that says if a case goes to the Seventh Circuit, this is what happens. In the Fifth Circuit, that's what happens. Can you see the inherent problem in all of these things? It shows up in lots of other contexts. If somebody says patentees are more likely to win with the jury than a judge, I think was the decision, it was the opinion as a result. Why do we not really know if that result is right? What's wrong with the methodology of counting cases that go to judges or cases that go to juries? Let's take a much easier case. Suppose somebody says, it's true that Harvard is very expensive, but people who graduate from Harvard get much better jobs than people who graduate from University of Mississippi. So you should be willing to pay that price to go to Harvard if they'll let you in. And in fact, he says, we're going to do some arithmetic. It turns out people who graduate from Harvard make $400,000 more during their lifetime than people who graduate from University of Mississippi. So you should be willing to pay anything up to $400,000 to go to Harvard. What is wrong with that argument? Yes?
I guess the individual that graduated from Harvard might not.
Well, they might, but this is an average after all. Yeah?
It's assuming causation.
In particular, it is assuming that the same people go to Harvard as go to University of Mississippi. All right? Most of the people at University of Mississippi couldn't get into Harvard. So it's combining two different effects. It's combining the actual value of going to Harvard with the filtering effect of the fact that the people who are going to Harvard are those people who would have done well if they went to University of Mississippi, because they're the very smartest people at University of Mississippi. Make sense? But in any of these things, you've got to think about that problem. Because otherwise your statistical results, and this is useful to know as a lawyer, because people will make arguments of this sort and you want to defeat. Because any of these arguments you have to ask, how are the incoming streams filtered? So let's go back to Texas versus Illinois for patent law. If it's true that we know that the Texas courts are very, I don't know which they were, say, pro, I don't know whether pro-infringer or pro-patent. So they're very pro-infringer. In that case, people who have infringer, in that case, patentees who have a strong case might be willing to take it to Texas, but ones with a weak case certainly won't. But they might still want to go to Illinois where they could. So if you think about a situation where you've got forum shopping, the forum shopping itself means that the selection of cases going to the different forums isn't the same. And you therefore can't just generalize from the outcome what the treatment effect is, what the effect is of the forum. Ditto in this judge versus jury. That to the extent, I don't know, does anybody know in the case of patent cases, what determined whether a case went to the judge or the jury? Who, is it the plaintiff who decides, do you know? Who is it who decides whether to allow a bench trial in? You're the lawyers, or about to be lawyers. You're supposed to tell me these things. I'm not a lawyer. Yeah?
My memory is, sorry, if the prior fact establishes whether or not there's an infringement of the claim as constructed by the prior law, that the defendant can opt to have it go to a bench trial rather than...
So it's the defendant, you think?
Yeah, I believe it's the defendant it, has the
If that's right, then you would expect that cases that the defendants would opt for whichever one they thought was more sympathetic, and it then might depend on how strong a case they had, how willing they were to do that, and that then might give you an apparent bias which wasn't the real bias. The case where this problem shows up, not in our case, is that every once in a while you will see a news story which says that doing X is good for you or bad for you, that drinking wine is good for your health. The statistical evidence, have I mentioned this one before? It was an interesting case. But the statistical evidence is that small amounts of alcohol can sometimes make you healthier. But we don't really know if it's true, because there are reasons why some people drink more or less wine, and those reasons might be. Similarly, I think one of, there have been a number of posters around here by some group that's trying to persuade law students not to use drugs and alcohol. And you've probably all seen them. And I was going to photograph one or two of them, because one or two of them seem to me to be good examples for a different course I teach on bad statistics. That is to say, if you say, for example, that's right, there was one of them was something like that students in the bottom third of their class are more likely to drink than students who are doing better. I mean, something like that. Well, think about that for a minute. It might mean they're in the bottom third of the class because they're drinking, but it might also be drinking because they're in the bottom third of their class, right? And, you know, you all know you should stay out of hospitals because the death rate in hospitals is very high. Right? It's really a very dangerous place to be. So you do want to think more generally whenever you're looking at statements of this sort. Now, the right way of dealing with it, which we usually can't do, is a true controlled experiment. So a true controlled experiment is the experiment where you can say, all right, we've got a bunch of volunteers. You people are going to drink one glass of wine a day, no more nor less. You people are not allowed to drink any alcohol at all, and you people have to drink at least three glasses of wine a day. All right, and we can somehow monitor this for a couple of years and then see what happens to your health. That would be a controlled experiment, really hard to do. All right. Sometimes you can do a natural experiment. And my favorite example of this actually goes back to the Harvard question. And that was a paper I read a summary of. And what the people did was to look at students who had been admitted to an elite college, some of whom chose to go and some of whom didn't. And then to ask what were their wages after they got out of college. And the conclusion was that going to an elite college resulted in higher wages at your first job but not thereafter. Which seems sort of plausible because it gives some information to the employer, but then he's got better information thereafter. Now, it's not perfect, because you have to ask why do some people decide to go and not to go. And you might say, well, the people who went to the elite college on average are richer. That's one reason why you're willing to pay that. Therefore, since on average they're richer, maybe rich people either make more or less money. You could think you're rich and lazy, or they're rich and have good connections, or you can have lots of different possible theories. Alternatively, you could say, well, look, the reason that the people didn't go to Harvard was that Harvard didn't offer them a good scholarship. Who does Harvard offer a good scholarship to? The really good students. So again, you would be getting a biased sample. So you always have to worry about it, but that's sort of as close as you can often come to doing a clean natural experiment, and I think it's worth thinking about how you would do that. And notice that our reading for next class, well, I shouldn't say notice, we probably haven't read it yet, but our reading for next class really involves some of these issues, because part of what the authors are trying to do is to figure out whether having intellectual property protection results in more or less innovation. And again, we don't have the right experiment. Would be to say, all right, we are going to be randomly dividing the states of the U.S. in half, flip a coin for which one goes which. Half of them get patent law and half of them don't. Wait 50 years and see what happens. That even wouldn't be very good because you can parrot ideas made in the state next to you. So we really need different worlds. All right, we need multiple worlds with no connection between them, and one world has patent law and one world doesn't, and see what happens. And that would be a very nice experiment, but with a little difficulty. But I should say we're getting closer to being able to do this. I've been suggesting for some time, and I'm sure someone out there is actually doing it. I'm much better at telling other people what to do than at doing it myself. But I've been suggesting that games like World of Warcraft make possible controlled experiments in the social sciences. Because the way the world of Warcraft and similar games works is that each server is an independent world. Each server is a bunch of players who are interacting with each other, mostly not across. And you could imagine, if you had some theory, suppose we had a theory about how slang spreads, for example. You could imagine introducing a particular phrase into 50 servers, a different one into a different 50. All right. And there is actually an area of human activity which does this, which I was really interested to discover many, many years ago because I had some friends in advertising. Does anybody know what a split run is in advertising? You and I are both advertising copywriters, and we're working on an ad which is going to go into a magazine with a thing you clip out and send in for something. Nowadays we do it online, but this was a long time ago. And I think the headline ought to be this. And you say, nah, I won't get anybody. The headline ought to be that. So what you end up doing is that every other copy of the magazine has my headline and every other copy has your headline. And the coupon that's sent in by the responder has something on it that says which headline it has. And we do the experiment and the result comes in and sure enough, one of the headline draws three times as much as the other. Isn't that neat? For any of you who actually write, if you sort of imagine being able to do a controlled experiment on what writing works, it's just a brilliant idea. Coming out of the advertising industry, which is a strange place for brilliant ideas to come out of, but maybe not. Yes?
Going back to the problems.
Right.
Can you explain why regressional analysis can't really, kind of weed out different possible variables that is not as effective as
Because, that is, first, it's got to be done carefully, but second, because you do not know whether you have all the relevant variables. That is, you're talking about multiple regressions, and the standard procedure for a multiple regression is you say, we think that the crime rate depends on how severe criminal sentences are, say that's your theory. But we know the crime rate's got to depend on a lot of other things as well. So you set up a regression, you're going to do this cross interstate or over time or something. And so you say, well, crime rate,
is this an erasable one?
Yes, it's a plain free dry erase. It's also almost dead, though.
Is this also plain free dry erase, I hope?
Yes, it's also plain free dry erase. So your guess is that crime rate equals some level plus B times the severity of punishment plus C times the percentage of the population, percent male 16 to 30, say. There's some age group which men commit lots more crimes than anybody else, plus some other variables. And you then get the closest fit you can. These are all, this is by state. By state and so forth. So you then look at all the states and you say what values of these numbers most closely fit the actual data. And you then say, all right, well, the value of B is such and such, that tells us how much severity affects it. And the problem, one problem with that, there are a couple of problems. One problem is that there may be some variables left out, maybe because you don't have any data for them. A further problem is that there may be variables that affect both this and this. The causation, they go in the other direction. Suppose what's really going on is that states where there's a culture of violence, both criminals are willing to beat people up and judges are willing to sentence people for a long term. So then that cultural violence will make it look as though severe punishments are associated with high crime rates. Not because the severe punishment causes the high crime rate, but because the same thing causes both the high crime rate and the severe punishment. All right, so those are some of the problems. And there's a course I sometimes teach here, which is called Quantitative Methods for Lawyers, and which is a week or two each on a bunch of things, and we spend a couple of weeks on statistics. So if I ever teach that course again and you're still around, we can discuss this stuff at more detail. But I should, since I've got a couple of minutes to burn anyway, and I think I've said what I wanted to say, mention something else about statistics, which is probably more important. And that is that statistical results are often put in terms of something like a confidence interval or a confidence measure. And almost everybody who reads these and many people who writes them do not understand what it means. Suppose the question is, does aspirin cause heart attacks? And somebody says, we've proved at the 0.01 level that aspirin causes heart attacks. And that's normally interpreted to mean there's only one chance in 100 that aspirin doesn't cause heart attacks. But in fact, that result cannot be produced by classical statistics. What it really means is that if aspirin doesn't cause heart attacks, the chance that our research would have given as evidence this strong that it does is only 1 in 100. Sounds like a subtle difference, but let me give you my standard example. I don't have any coins in my pocket, so I'll have to use an imaginary coin. All right, I pulled an imaginary coin out of my pocket, and my theory is that it's a double-headed coin. All right. My experiment is going to consist of flipping it twice without, of course, looking at the back side. That would be cheating. Flip it twice, heads, heads. All right? What are the odds that if it is not a double, if my theory is wrong, if it's a fair coin, what are the odds that I will have gotten heads twice? One out of four, of course, right? One and two for once, one and four for twice. Does it follow that the odds are now 3-1 that it's a double-headed coin? The probability of getting evidence this good that it's double-headed is only 25%. That doesn't mean that the probability that it's not double-headed is only 25%. Because what's really going on is that we know that almost all coins are not double-headed. Almost all coins have heads and tails. So the probability that I pulled a fair coin and then made a one in four chance out of it is much higher than the chance that I pulled a double-headed coin and then made a certainty out of it. This gets you into something called Bayesian statistics, which tries to use this kind of approach. But the basic point I want to make is that if anybody in any law case you're involved in uses confidence statements in the form of the probability this is true is only such and such, he almost certainly does not understand them, or hopes you don't understand them, and you ought to find somebody who can explain statistics to the jury or to the judge to show that that isn't really what it means at all. All right? Think about DNA testing. Somebody says the chance that we've proved he's 99, the odds are 99-1 that he's guilty. What does he mean? The chance that the DNA would match this well by chance is only 1 in 100. On the other hand, he was on the other side of the country when the crime occurred. So the chance that the DNA would match this high by chance is only 1 in 100. It doesn't follow the chance that he's innocent is only 1 in 100. He's got other evidence as well. Huh? Anyway, enough of that. But fine, we used our time. Hopefully productively, even if not all of it was on IP. So read the next chunk and just help make up your mind as to whether we should abolish patent law or not. And you don't have to worry about my job prospects. By the time they abolish patent law, I'll be retired anyway. So will you. Probably, yes, you're right.